You're listening to Charlottesville's Podcasting Network at SevillePodcast.com. Lectures, radio shows, and more are available on demand at SevillePodcast.com. Now available through email. Sign up today. I'm Dan Gould. Regular listeners of our podcast might know Rick Britton. He's an award-winning historian and cartographer and a frequent guest on WINA's Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot. Rick also organizes a Civil War lecture and day trip series in conjunction with the Charlottesville Senior Center. On Wednesday, May 18, 2011, former editor with the papers of U.S. Grant Bill Ferrero delivered a fascinating talk on the life and military career of this famous general. Born in Ohio in 1822 and an 1843 graduate of West Point, Grant finished the Mexican War as a captain with citations for gallantry and meritorious conduct. During the Civil War, Grant rose steadily in the ranks, from colonel to general-in-chief of the armies. Here's Bill Ferraro.
Well, thank you very much. Very pleased to be here tonight. I don't often get a chance to come out and talk, which if you're a teaching professor, you do it regularly, but when you're an editor, you work on documents, you look at computer screens, so it's always nice to come out and look at people and actually share a lot of the information that I've been able to accrue over the many years I've been a professional historian. I worked 14 and a half years on the papers of Ulysses S. Grant. While I was there, we edited the time of Grant's presidency through the 8 years he lived in retirement. And then I worked right on through that and extensively worked on the last year of his life, which was fascinating. So I never worked directly with the Civil War, but the Civil War was always part of the process. He was always reflecting back on it, the process of writing his memoirs, veterans meetings and the like. And then I've done a lot of work as well on William Tecumseh Sherman and the extended Sherman family. So I have a lot of background and a lot of things I want to share. As you can see, I have a little PowerPoint presentation, so you'll get to see some pictures and hopefully give a little structure to the talk as I move through. And I've titled this talk, Maintaining Momentum, Ulysses S. Grant as Commander-in-Chief of the Union Army. But there will be some background before then and not much afterwards. My goal tonight is to give you some insights into Grant's success as a general, which is really what drives the real flood of books that continue to come out on Grant. And there's still a lot left to be said about him in terms of detail and emphasis. But my thinking and studying of Grant, I've come to the conclusion that his success as a general, broadly speaking, is a blend of simplicity and sophistication. It really doesn't get beyond that. It certainly wasn't magic, but one of his great skills was to keep things relatively simple, and that's what maintaining momentum really was a large part of that simplicity. And I hope to expound on that a little bit through the talk. Now, this goes all the way back to the beginning, and this is one insight that I think I'm going to bring in my ongoing work on Grant that people have really missed. The standard interpretation is that Grant's father was an albatross, a pain, someone who belittled Ulysses Grant when he was a boy, caused him lots of political problems when he was adult, and just really was a problem in his life. And that his mother was non-existent, just not a factor at all. You know, quiet, you know, homebody, and things of that like. So they were married in 1821 in Claremont, Ohio, and Ulysses Grant was their oldest child. Now, what I want to say, though, is that they were fundamentally important, both his parents and then his family as a whole. His mother, primarily, everyone who knew her says she was a wonderful woman, was very sweet, very nurturing, very kind. His father was a driving businessman. He was a tanner and also involved in other land acquisitions, and he was really making money along the way, and he did become financially successful. But he was very much a presence in Grant's life. And they went on to have 6 children. Now, if you look at this roster of his family, the striking thing about it, and if you don't know how many are familiar with demographic information from the 19th century, really pre-modern, mid to late 20th century medicine, is that there are 6 children in this family. They all lived to adulthood. As far as I know, There is not one stillbirth or any kind of loss. This was an intact family. This was extremely unusual in the 19th century. And it was a very intact family. They always stayed together. They always lived in the same household. They moved from one part of southern Ohio, Georgetown, where Grant was born in Point Pleasant, then he grew up in Georgetown, Ohio. And then after he went off to West Point, the family moved again in Ohio. And they scattered out. But as a whole, Grant grew up in a very intact family. His mother and his father were there. His sister was there. He didn't know traumas. And modern brain science has contended, and it has a lot of scientific evidence behind it, that a real stable, nurturing environment for a child is critical to that child developing good brain function, the ability to stay calm, the ability to stay composed, the ability to have confidence. It doesn't guarantee it, but it provides a foundation. So from my point of view, this is one of the great reasons or explanations going deep back into a childhood. That you say, where does Grant remain, keep his calm? When everyone else is going crazy on battlefields, everyone always said he kept his composure. He made decisions. He acted. So I would like to contend it's rooted in his childhood and family experience. And he was also a very capable, competent child. Rode horses wonderfully, took trips, carted things around. He went off on his own. He was very independent, showed a lot of wherewithal as a son. Very fortunate, didn't drown when he was about 8 or 9 years old. There's lots of things you can get onto his sides with him, but I'll skip that because we need to move ahead. We're not going to be here forever. Now, another critical point, his name. I would say, over the years I've worked with Ulysses S. Grant and people who have known I've worked with him, the question I get most often is, what was his name? You know, how did his name change? Isn't his name Ulysses Simpson Grant? And there is no doubt about it from the documentary evidence. I won't go through all the details. His name initially was Hiram Ulysses Grant. That was the name the family gave him. His father preferred Ulysses, and so that's what they called him. And he was generally called Lys Ulysses as a boy. When he's going to go off to West Point, and this is the gentleman, Thomas Hamer, who was the representative of Ohio who gave him the appointment to West Point, he had to put in the application. And he didn't realize that his name was Hiram Ulysses Grant, because he just was Ulysses. And he thought that his middle name must be Simpson, which was his mother's maiden name. So he just put down S on the application, thinking it was Simpson, but he never put that down. In the records at the West Point, he's Ulysses S. Grant. But Ulysses did not want Hiram Ulysses Grant, because when you abbreviate that, it's H-U-G. And when you put H-U-G on a trunk, it spells hug. And he didn't want to get teased when he showed up at West Point. So working with an uncle, whom he was very close, they switched it to Ulysses Hiram Grant, U-H-G. And that's what they put on the trunk. But when he shows up at West Point, his records all say Ulysses S. Grant. And because of red tape, unless he signs his name in as Ulysses S. Grant, they're not going to let him in. He's going to have to go back and redo all the paperwork, and that's just way too much hassle. So he adopts the name Ulysses S. Grant. And this is the critical point. The S in the middle is only an S. You will see in miscellaneous publications, even notable ones, from different presses and different biographical directories of presidents, they'll put Simpson in there. Simpson. It's just wrong. It's Ulysses S. Grant. All right. That is the name that he adopts and he carries on into his adult life. And the S, as he himself said at different points, just doesn't stand for anything. So here is a picture of Grant upon his graduation from West Point in 1843. And he graduates as a brevet second lieutenant. There hadn't been much going on in the Army. There was a lot of, there weren't many vacancies. So you stayed a brevet second lieutenant to a regular second lieutenancy opened up. Now, another consideration with Grant when you read about him is people say he was pretty dull. He wasn't really a bright guy. He just graduated, you know, toward the middle, back middle of his class. He wasn't smart at all. Really important to realize, 21 of 39, which was his formal graduation numbers, really is pretty good, because the United States Military Academy is one of the very best colleges in the country, in the world almost at that time. Plus, the class started with over 70 people. So of the people who began, he was in clearly in the top third, because all the other 30 washed out before they got to the graduation. Plus, and this is the critical factor, Grant really didn't try hard when he was at West Point. He wasn't that enthused about being a soldier. He himself said he spent most of his time reading novels. He picked up math very readily, and he just didn't study. He did not apply himself. He was not real careful about shining his uniform buttons and keeping his boots polished and things like that. So he got a fair number of demerits. He wasn't real big on personal appearance. So instead of saying, hey, he was a pretty stupid guy at West Point, you know, he was toward the back end of the class, I think it's a better way to look at Ulysses S. Grant at West Point is he finished in the middle of the class, the top third of all who entered, and he didn't even try. All right? This was just kind of showing up. So to me, that clearly shows he's a pretty bright guy. And his native IQ and his native wherewithal is quite high. And again, that comes out later, because he never got the sense at any point in Grant's life that he really, really was someone who studied. There is some evidence that he was doing some studying of military tactics early in his Army career, but I never get the sense that he was one of these guys that was a bookworm, that was really boning up and studying. He just kind of intuited things. He learned very readily from experience, he observed, and he talked. He talked a lot, and he thrashed things out in his mind with other people who were interested. So after he graduates from West Point, he goes off on a few peacetime assignments, but it wasn't that long till you get the Mexican War. Mexican War and Grant's career and his life is really important because here he experiences battle. Plus, in his service as a quartermaster, he learns an awful lot about logistics, supply, being responsible for larger commands, and just having to deal with crises as they developed. And there were a lot of different crises of moving people and getting things at different places in a timely fashion he had to contend with. These are the major battles that Grant participated in. He was in an infantry unit, and you can read which ones they are. And the other important thing about the Mexican War, and this is a point that I think military historians, particularly people who look at generals, forget, and it's critical, though. One of the most important achievements that Grant managed during his time as a junior officer was not to get shot. Because who knows how many great generals there may have been if they weren't shot when they were second lieutenants or captains. Who knows? But Grant didn't. I mean, not only was he not shot seriously, he never, as far as I know, took any kind of wound whatsoever. Question people ask, did Grant ever kill somebody? We don't know for certain. We don't know if he ever actually shot. But we do know he did fire artillery, and he was involved in some pretty hot conflicts. So he probably did inflict a wound on another person sometime during the Mexican War. During the Civil War, I don't think so at all. But during the Mexican War, it's possible. But he had a lot of battlefield experience. And then he rehashed and thought about and talked about his Mexican War experiences constantly over the years after the Mexican War. It was his favorite topic of conversation, that and horses, which was his lifetime interest, which he talked a lot about. He was an exceptional horse rider. Now, while Grant's in the Army, he's always torn between staying in the Army, for which he didn't have a lot of early enthusiasm, but he kind of got comfortable. He got an officer's commission. He was elevated to a first lieutenant after the Mexican War, brevet captain. And he, it was comfortable life. You had a salary. You had somebody that was going on. And early in his Army career, he'd met Julia Dent at St. Louis, his first posting. And she was the sister of his last West Point roommate, Frederick T. Dent. And so they were long engaged while he was serving down in Mexico. And then as soon as the Mexican War got over and he was able to get a furlough, which he wanted for well over a year, never was able to manage, he came back and they got married. And he and Julia had four children themselves. And as far as I know, there were no early childhood deaths, no miscarriages, nothing at all either. And he was very devoted to his family. He was very devoted to his wife. So this is all going on during the Mexican War, then after the Mexican War at his different postings. And he was in some out-of-the-way places, Sackett Harbor, New York, Detroit when it was just sort of beginning. It was kind of a real frontier outpost. And then he got sent out to California. And in California, he wasn't making enough money to keep his family with him. And there were also issues of distance, and then Julia wanting to stay with her father in St. Louis. So he was out there by himself, and he had some difficult times in California. and it was out there in 1854, he basically chose his family over the army, and he resigned his commission. He had just been promoted to captain, but he resigned that captaincy and decided, I'm going to go home and be with my family. So he comes back to St. Louis, where he has some acreage on Dent, a family acreage that he's farming. Now, he goes into a real period of obscurity during St. Louis, and it's ones that people usually look at and say, this guy's a complete failure. And in a way, he was a failure financially. He really ran into some money problems, but he was very happy emotionally. He did work hard, and he did take care of his family. He built this log cabin, which you can go out to St. Louis and see. It's still out there. Bush Enterprises own it. They have a farm in the Clydesdale, people with Budweiser beer. And anybody was always straggling for money, but evidently he was trying to get some Christmas presents here in December of 1857 because he pawned a gold watch that he had to get some cash. And in general, you know, the period of time, he says it was an okay period, but clearly it didn't go well in terms of the finances, and he needed money. And as the 1850s were over, he took up becoming a realtor. He was a terrible realtor and property manager because he just did not have the gumption to go up and get somebody to pay their rent, all right, or to pay bills and things like that. So that was very short-lived. And then his father offered him a clerkship at one of the tannery businesses, merchant houses that he at this time had opened in Galena, Illinois. He had other ones at different spots in the Ohio River Valley, Upper Mississippi Valley, and he accepted that, where basically now he was going to be an employee under one of his younger brothers. And this is where Grant was when the Civil War begins. He's in Galena, Illinois. And I've never been in Galena, Illinois. I lived in southern Illinois for 14 and a half years, but that's 6.5 hours from Galena at least, and that was one of the few places I didn't get to. I saw a lot of other real interesting things out in the Midwest in the time I was out there, but never Galena. The house that he lived in after the war is there. The one he lived in before the war is not. So he's up in Galena when the war starts, and Grant, being conscientious and believing that the government had educated him to be a soldier and he believed in the Union cause, he was going to join the Army. So he goes down to Springfield, Illinois, and basically volunteers his services to the governor of Illinois and says, I'm here and can help organize the Army. What do you want me to do? So he's one of the few people who knows the bookkeeping and record keeping and recruitment and enrollment and all these things. So they basically have him pushing paper for a week or two and trying to train other people. But very quickly, he goes to try to get a regular commission in the Army. There's a story about him not being able to see George McClellan and other sorts of oddball things, which I'll skip that. But he comes back to Springfield, and there's a regiment out there, the 21st Illinois, who the colonel just hasn't gotten any control over. So he is given command of that regiment. He takes that regiment on a couple of small-scale marches and excursions into Missouri. And because of his previous service in the Mexican War, his being a West Point graduate, and the fact that this gentleman, Elihu B. Washburn, is a resident of Galena and is very interested in advancing the careers of his constituents, and there's a need to fill up some of the higher ranks of the officers' corps as this rapidly expanding Union Army, he's able to get Ulysses S. Grant a commission as Brigadier General. And so without having done all that much in the field, in the very beginning of the Civil War, Grant becomes a Brigadier General, and he takes command in extreme southern Illinois over to Cape Girardeau, Missouri, the area that was initially impacted by the flooding that's now moved itself further down the Mississippi. And he's based largely in Cairo, Illinois. And this is a great picture, and it's one reason why I have it. This is Grant with a long beard. It's the only known picture that I'm aware of with Grant with that long beard. Evidently, Julia hated it, and she said, no way can you wear the beard that long, and she compelled him to trim it, and he wore the more groomed look, which we'll see in other pictures, for the rest of his life. So this was his one chance of being on the wild side, and Julia reined him right in. So this is Grant's early Civil War actions. And again, a lot of this is just as more of an overview. But it gives you an idea of how he did things. I mean, early in the Civil War, a lot of sitting around was done, a lot of organizing, a lot of logistical effort. You think about McClellan in the East. Well, Grant didn't plan and organize endlessly. He just went out and sort of did things. And these are some of the notable, most notable things he did. When the Confederates start moving into Kentucky, he immediately, without orders, occupied Paducah, Kentucky. Well, that was a critical strategic location, because that's right where the Tennessee River comes into the Mississippi River. And so that gave the Union control of that Tennessee River going down into the heart of the Confederacy. And so he occupied that, and then it was considered, okay, a good thing to do. And so the Union had control of Paducah, Kentucky. And then instead of just sitting around with skirmishing and scouting, he took his troops out that he had in southeastern Missouri, and they raided a outpost at Belmont, Missouri. Battle didn't go particularly well. They landed, they pushed the army, the Confederates that were there, away, but then there was a counterattack by the Confederates. And it was very close to basically driving the Union forces back into the river. But Grant was able to break through, attempt to surround them, and get everyone back on the boats, and got back upriver. And by all reports, he was the last guy over the plank. He rode his horse up the plank onto the steamboat, and he could have been picked off, but again, he was lucky not to be shot. But a minor battle, except that it showed Grant's ability, A, to fight, to actually do something, and then when things were going badly in a battle, he kept his composure and he turned it around. Occupies Fort Henry. This is then he says, okay, we need to drive down the Tennessee River. This is the beginning of his drive down the Tennessee River. Fort Henry basically falls to ironclad riverboats, and Grant immediately says, okay, let's continue on up further the river and see if we can take this larger installation, Fort Donelson, which he does. And again at Fort Donelson, he puts a lot of pressure on the Confederates, has some early success. There's a counterattack. He re-counterattacks. And then puts pressure on the fort. The three Confederate generals there, two of them panic big time. They say, we got to get out of here. One is left, Simon Buckner, and he ends up surrendering. But relatively speaking, it's an even Stevens battle. And it just was Grant being there and poised to keep striking that he basically overawed the Confederates. He just put more pressure on, and he just said, I'm tougher than you are. I mean, we're going to fight. We're not going to run away. At that battle, the one guy who completely disagreed with the top general's decision to surrender was Nathan Bedford Forrest, and he snuck out because they did not have the whole fort surrounded, and he took most of his cavalry troopers out, much to Grant's chagrin, because he caused a lot of trouble for Grant through the war. So it wasn't long after Donelson that he ran into a political problem with Henry Halleck, the larger commander in the West, because he didn't report properly. And so he had a squawk with Halleck, but he finally sorted that out in the middle of March. And just a few weeks later, there's the Battle of Shiloh, where the Union Army was staging troops to drive down into Mississippi. And while they were staging troops, the Confederates attacked. And a huge debate, historiographically and at the time, as to whether Grant was caught off guard, whether William Tecumseh Sherman was caught off guard. Point being, they certainly weren't totally ready to take the attack. And the Confederates got the best of it on the first day and really drove them back to the river. But Grant established a perimeter, brought a lot of forces to bear, and then when everyone was saying, well, it would be wise to withdraw, he was like, no, we're going to attack in the morning, and we're going to drive them. And in that panicky night that was pouring rain and it was really difficult, he kept his head, and the next morning they attacked with the troops that they had, and later reinforcements coming in, and they drove the Confederates back in disarray. That was a battle that Albert Sidney Johnson, the Confederate commander, got shot and died. And people always say maybe it would have been a different battle if Johnson hadn't been killed. And that's right. Maybe it would have been a different battle if their commanding general hadn't been killed. But he was leading a regimental charge, which wasn't really the best activity by a commanding general. So this was picture of Grant about the time of Shiloh. You see the neatly trimmed, groomed beard. And he won the battle, so he's looking pretty confident here. 1863, he has two major successes. The Vicksburg Campaign, which again, it bogged down in the winter, the river was high. But once he got moving toward Vicksburg, and put the pressure on Pemberton and his army. He just had those guys in flight. I mean, he never gave them a moment's rest until he pinned them back in the city. They tried direct assaults. They didn't take the defenses, but he knew he had them pretty well bottled up, and he just kept the pressure on until they were compelled to surrender on the 4th of July. By this time, there's been a lot of notice taken of Grant by Lincoln and others in the East, and when things were going very badly in the eastern Tennessee, northern Georgia area, William Rosecrans fleeing from Chickamauga back up into Chattanooga, where his troops were basically hemmed in, Grant is ordered to go to Chattanooga and see what he can do to straighten that out. And so he had injured himself falling off a horse. This is one of the times during the war that people claimed he was drinking and was drunk. And then we can get to 3 hours talking about whether Grant drank during the war or not. But he gets himself to Chattanooga despite having a very painful leg injury, immediately seizes control over what's going on, establishes a supply line, which Rosecrans was utterly incapable of doing, relieves Rosecrans of command, and has Tecumseh Sherman march the Army of the Tennessee across, gets other troops together and organized, and within a matter of weeks, not only does he have Chattanooga stabilized, he's attacking the besieging Confederate Army and drives them off, and again, in disarray. And this is Braxton Bragg. And so this was like a miracle. I mean, we had a situation that 1 month looked like we're going to lose a whole Union army, and the next month Grant appeared, and in 1 month's time, he's driven away an entire Confederate army and has completely consolidated the area. So Lincoln, this is a picture of Grant here in 1863 when he's achieving these great victories at Vicksburg and Chattanooga. The thing I like about these pictures, you look at his face, and he seems very confident, very composed in the face. But you look at his hands, it's like he doesn't know what he should be doing with his hands, particularly in this picture. It's like he's got the fidgets. I mean, I just don't know. I mean, maybe looking at it now, this thought occurred to me, he doesn't have the cigar in his mouth. So maybe without the cigar, he's just got, you know, he's got like the withdrawal symptoms or something. But his all his achievements to 1863, and, you know, he's on a roll here. He's not really losing too much. Is they pass legislation in Congress to make the lieutenant general, and it's obvious that this person is going to be Ulysses S. Grant. So he comes to Washington, D.C. in 1864, which is the first time he meets Lincoln. Lincoln's only reservation is rumors that Grant's going to run for president in 1864. Grant sends his chief of staff, John A. Rawlins, a friend from Galena, who assures Lincoln, furthest thing from this man's mind. He has no political aspirations whatsoever. Lincoln satisfied, no problem. Comes, meets Lincoln, and he's commissioned as lieutenant general in early March of 1864. So, as the general commander-in-chief of all the armies, he now is not just responsible for his immediate command, he has come up with a plan for everybody all over the country. And this is the basic outline of Grant's plan. And the key concept that Grant comes up with is continuous pressure. No more attack, withdraw, wait, sit around, debate, reorganize, recruit, continuous pressure all across the country, all possible fronts. So Army of the Potomac, which is the Union Army, is going to operate in Northern Virginia, directly against the Army of Northern Virginia. There's the Army of the James, which is going to operate on the Virginia coast, coming up the rivers from the Tidewater. Out in the Department of West Virginia, in the Shenandoah Valley, there's going to be Union armies operating out there, putting pressure on the Confederate forces in Shenandoah. And the primary area of operation in the West, you're going to have the combined armies of the Tennessee, Cumberland, and Ohio pushing from Chattanooga down toward Atlanta. There's also things happening further out in Missouri and outlying areas. But this is where the main Confederate armies are at and the main areas of political and economic importance for the Confederacy. And Grant's notion was all these attacks are going to begin in early May, and they're to continue consistently in all areas, and this should crush the Confederacy just by the weight of the Union effort. George G. Meade had been the commander of the Army of the Potomac. You'll learn a lot about him when you go to Gettysburg. But Grant decides to keep him in command of the Army of the Potomac, but he's primarily responsible for administrative duties only. Grant travels with the Army of the Potomac, and he exercises direct control over the primary military movements. also allowed Grant to stay out of Washington, D.C. in the political hothouse, which could create all manner of complications for an Army general. So Grant's handicapped. I mean, he's doing good things, but he's got to rely on others. And his plan goes awry largely because of these two failures. Benjamin Butler, the Army of the James, basically manages to do nothing. In the report on the activities of the Army during the spring of 1864, Grant characterizes that Butler and his army were like in a bottle strongly corked down on the peninsula. They just got hemmed in, and they just never did much of anything. Franz Sigel, who, when he finally was dismissed from command by Grant, said something to the effect that I order Sigel dismissed because his record is one of continuous failure or continuous lack of success. He was responsible in the Shenandoah Valley. Well, he was just consistently getting pushed from one place to another out in the Shenandoah Valley, and eventually he was supplanted by David Hunter. He didn't do much better. And eventually you get Philip Sheridan. I'll show you when Sheridan goes out there. But this is two parts of his plan just don't work. So this was not a good thing. Fortunately for Grant, though, out in the West, he had his good friend, William Tecumseh Sherman, and he did do what he was supposed to do. He maintained a continuous drive toward Atlanta, pushed the Confederate Army to Tennessee back. It took a little longer than he would have liked, but he takes Atlanta in September, early September of 1864, then goes on the march to Savannah and eventually drives through the Carolinas with nary a break. It was one of the great logistical achievements, certainly of the Civil War and of any sort of warfare before we had modern mechanized trucks, tanks, motorized transport, the ground they covered and what they did. So what was going on out there is exactly what they want. So the Western Army couldn't detach for the East. And Grant, of course, commanding the Army of the Potomac against Army of Northern Virginia, he did what he was supposed to do, and that was to keep Lee under intense pressure at all times. So the day that they set to start the attack was 4 May 1864. And this is a drawing from a newspaper artist of Grant writing a telegram back to Washington saying that the marches have begun, the armies are advancing into Virginia. And this is a contemporary picture of the Union troops going over the Rapidan River, which I always think about when I'm driving north to Washington, D.C., and you go over the Rapidan up 29, and think, this is the way they came south. So they're moving. And as you probably know, they didn't get too far. And Lee said, okay, you want to fight? We're going to fight. And they have the Battle of the Wilderness. This is a picture of Grant whittling, which is what he did. He used to just sort of take a knife to a stick during battles, and he didn't make anything. He just whittled at it. It wasn't art. It was just nerves, and he would think. And then he would write orders. So this is Grant during the Battle of the Wilderness, which was just basically a slugfest, where they really couldn't see each other, and the two armies just really mauled each other to no particular advance, which was the story pretty much of the entire spring campaign, is there was an awful lot of killing and not a whole lot of tactical or strategic gain. But what Grant did is he kept the pressure on. He maintained the momentum. He retained the initiative where Lee could not really do anything, to greatly impede or hinder Grant, nor could he do anything elsewhere in the South to stop some of the other threats. So normally, under previous commanders, once there had been a big battle, a lot of bloodletting, the armies retreated a while and they regrouped. Well, this is a depiction of the famous coming to the crossroads where they could have headed north to regroup, but instead Grant chooses the road south to Spotsylvania Courthouse on 7 May. And that's Grant on the horse there in the middle. And supposedly the troops all started cheering and yelling because they weren't going to give up or they weren't beaten. They were still going to fight. That decision to drive south leads to the Battle of Spotsylvania, which takes place over several days. And this is, again, a couple of newspaper artist drawings of the fighting. This is on the first day of 9 May. And again, this is just armies just mashing at each other. By the 12th of May, they've entrenched and thrown up breastworks, and there was an angle, sort of a point going out of the Confederate line, which was a focal point of a lot of the Union attacks, the enormous amount of casualties, and this is a depiction of that over here, the bloody angle of 12 May 1864. At the Battle of Spotsylvania, there was this gentleman, Emory Upton, who convinced Grant to try a tactical innovation. Instead of charging on wide lines of just, you know, soldier two per, he says, let's get it more like an arrow. Let's put a wedge and hit the wedge and then drive up and out to try to get behind then and break the lines, because there's no way you're going to get through those breastworks and those entrenchments with just one or two soldiers per. And so that did work, at least temporarily. The problem was coordinating the drives, but Upton got some battlefield brevets to higher ranks by Grant, and Grant really thought highly of him and was much chagrined late in his presidency when Upton committed suicide. He went on to write manuals of tactics and things like that. But he's an interesting figure who's often overlooked in the larger Civil War picture. So to speed things along, I'm giving you an outline here of the push towards Richmond. And again, seeing how much fighting and how rapidly they move. That they go from the Wilderness area, basically up Fredericksburg, down to Richmond in effectively a little less than a month. I mean, this is an area that, and enormous amounts of casualties on both sides. I should add that another one of the things Grant did in preparing for this attack was he took all the Union regiments out of the fortifications around Washington, D.C. And if you read the literature, you'll see these references as you start the spring campaign to the heavy regiments. And I can admit, when I was in high school and reading this, I was thinking, what do you mean by heavy regiments? Do they have like heavy artillery or something like that? No. What it was is these were regiments that had a full 1,000-man complements, which was the standard book size of a regiment. But since they had been in the fortifications, their losses were light and low. They were really had 1,000 people. The battlefield regiments usually only had 400 or 500 active troops. So they were heavy regiments because they were big. They really had lots of soldiers. But Grant's logic is, hey, we don't need to be sitting around guarding Washington. We need everyone we can have to fight. So he brought the heavy regiments out into the field, and they were a lot thinner by the time that month was over. There's no doubt about that. So this is just an outline of the battles. He'll be getting up to North Anna, which is a place I haven't seen. I've been up in Spotsylvania. I've been in the wilderness. And eventually get down to Cold Harbor, where I have been at. And they gather there in late May. And Grant tries to crack the line on 1 June, does not go well. But he feels if he can just thrash the Confederates at Cold Harbor, he can kind of go right into Richmond. They take the second day to reorganize, and on the 3rd of June, they try the assault again. And this assault lasts very brief time, and it gets mashed. And in his memoir, Grant writes, he regretted that assault more than any other. He also regretted the second assault at Vicksburg, but he blamed that on John McClernand. This one was entirely his call. And this is a depiction of the fighting that took place at Cold Harbor. And I don't know if you get over if you've seen it, but you see it. It was relatively short ground. You can see it was just a pretty hopeless situation. So now Grant is at a crossroads here after Cold Harbor. He's basically stalled, got the Chickahominy swamps, basically where McClellan stalled out. Really not much he can do. Direct assault doesn't look like it's going to do anything except lose tremendous numbers of soldiers. But instead of just pulling back or just twiddling his thumbs, he comes up with a brilliant tactical maneuver. And he moves his entire army to the south side of Richmond, crosses the James River. And he does this between 12 and 18 June. There's a lot of fancy feints and things like that. And so Lee doesn't realize this is happening until he has a significant number of troops across. He's also hoping that some troops from Butler can help out now. And it doesn't quite work out as he hoped. I mean, there weren't many Confederates in Petersburg, south of Richmond. But the Union forces were so exhausted from the continuous battling, they just didn't have the punch, particularly Winfield Scott's 2nd Corps, which was considered the elite corps of the Army of Potomac. They just had nothing left. And so they weren't able to drive through Petersburg and up to Richmond before Lee was able to get significant elements of the Army of Northern Virginia in place to stalemate the situation. But this completely changed the tactical scenario, because now Grant had all the pressure on Lee. He had an excellent base of supplies by water, which the Union Navy controlled, to keep that army supplied, and he basically had Lee pinned. south of Richmond, and he decides to settle down for a siege. So here you see a picture of the defensive works, which are a pretty formidable-looking system of entrenchments. And here you see a picture of the very heavy mortars and artillery that the Union Army brought up to blast away at the Confederates. During this period of time, Lee, who certainly is no fool, realizes he has to do something to distract Grant, to relieve the pressure, to create a political demonstration. And one idea he has is, okay, let's see if we can drive up and threaten Washington. Because obviously, Grant has all his forces here fighting me in Southern Virginia. So he sends Jubal Early from the Army, from the Richmond area, and it's kind of interesting, this map here, that you probably can't see that well. They do come through Charlottesville, and they go up the trains, and they start marching up the Shenandoah Valley between June 3 and the 12th, and they come circling around Northern Virginia and through Maryland to hit Washington. And this creates an enormous hullabaloo up amongst the politicians as he's getting closer and closer, because there really aren't significant Union military elements in the capital area. Grant is sort of poo-pooing it. Don't worry, he sent it back. I got it under control. And they gain a day on 9 July, because Early is his 20,000-man force is coming down on Washington, D.C., but they get stalled one day at the Battle of Monocacy. The Union commander in the Maryland area is Lew Wallace. How many people have heard of Lew Wallace? Probably many of you here. He ran into some problems with Grant at Shiloh. He was late getting there. It's interesting how their paths crossed again. But he wrote the novel Ben-Hur. He also was a governor of New Mexico, was trying to chase down Billy the Kid. He had a fabulous and interesting life. I've done a lot of work on him, including published an article on his relationship with Grant. But he has a great beard. He wore it long. Evidently, his wife didn't complain. But he stopped Early that one day, and that was vital, because now Grant realizes that something is really afoot there. And about the time the Confederates are approaching Washington, D.C., and threatening the forts, which aren't as fully manned as they used to be because Grant has pulled all those regiments out, but they've thrown invalid soldiers, soldiers on leaves, city volunteers into the forts, and they kind of stop them. And Early's attack is not concerted. It's kind of haphazard. But up at Fort Stevens in the northern part of the District of Columbia, they have an attack. Lincoln goes up there to check it out. This, no one actually has a photo. This is what an artist thinks they saw. There's all sorts of talks whether he was under fire, whether he almost was shot. But at this time, Grant has sent troops up from the Richmond area. And they get there on the 12th, sends 10,000 troops under General Horatio Wright. These are Army of the Potomac veterans. And they basically put to flight Early's command before they're able to get into D.C. And so that thrust, as Grant would argue, was his intent all the time. So if there's a real problem, I can always send enough troops back and we can contend with it. Doesn't relieve the pressure against Richmond. It doesn't really stop the momentum that Grant has gained. Now, Grant, on his part, isn't totally content with a total stalemate in Richmond. So he's willing to support an attempt to dig a tunnel under the Confederate lines and blow a big hole in them and then attack through, which becomes known as the Battle of the Crater. There's a regiment of Pennsylvania miners dug this mine, tunneled it under. The explosion was phenomenal, and it worked great. The problem was everything after that was horrible. The tactics, what to do, how to advance, how to get organized. So instead of troops sort of moving in and spreading out, they all basically jumped in the ditch. And the commander of the attack, an Italian gentleman named Ferrero, supposedly was drunk and nowhere to be found. But essentially, once the Confederates regrouped, regained their composure from this earth-shaking explosion, it was like the easiest battle they ever fought because they're just shooting at these soldiers who are scrambling in this big pit. So Grant, after he saw this and in his report, called it the saddest affair I have witnessed in this war. Such opportunity for carrying fortifications I have never seen and do not expect again to have. And it was an opportunity. They broke the line open. The Confederate troops were shocked, literally shocked, but they weren't able to take advantage of it, and everything faded back into the stalemate. More successful for Grant was the decision to send Phil Sheridan, his most aggressive offensive general in the East to take command of the Shenandoah Valley from Sigel and Hunter, who had proven to be incompetent. So he sends him out there on August 1 of 1864 with the orders to put himself south of the enemy and follow him to the death, which is basically what Sheridan does. I mean, you know, that's the interesting thing, that Sheridan's Valley campaign isn't fought north to south, it's fought south to north, and that he's pushing the Confederates further north, and you have the decisive battles up near Winchester. So he has some ups and downs, but through the fall, he basically smashes any sort of consequential Confederate power in the Shenandoah Valley. And he removes it at a place where they can move armies like Early, and also just destroys the provisions, the forage, and the food supplies, which makes things difficult for the army that's besieged in Richmond. This is a picture of Grant in 1864, and I had to get a good picture of Julie in here. She evidently was on a shopping trip up to New York while the active operations were going on in Virginia. This is probably the most famous picture of Grant taken in the vicinity of Cold Harbor, standing near the tree, you know, looking confident, sure of himself, which he was. He had ultimate, you know, just utmost confidence that they were going to succeed. City Point, which is a really fascinating place to see that deep water port right there on the river, is where Grant establishes headquarters, and he spent an awful lot of time from the summer of 1864 through the early spring of 1865. Julia eventually joined him there. There's Julia. The little shed that they show where he lived is only 10% the original shed, I found out to my chagrin when I visited a few years ago. This is his youngest son, Jesse Root Grant there, who I believe is about 5 in that picture. This is a picture of his numerous staff officers. Grant always had great relations with his family. His children adored him. And his staff, there's never really reports that he had difficulties with staff officers. Staff had a great deal of respect. Evidently, he was a real decent guy to work for. And he was at City Point, and he made it his base of operations. While the Army of Northern Virginia was pinned at Petersburg. And so this is a picture of the two principal generals in that period of time. And this was the whole idea. If we can't crush the Army of Northern Virginia, keep them pinned. Keep them in place so Sherman could keep moving through the South. Things could happen further out in the Mississippi. And the Confederates can't reorganize, can't regroup, can't catch their breath. This picture of Grant is from March 15 of 1865, just a few weeks before the decisive spring campaign begins. Awful lot of political maneuvering during this time. Various peace delegation, peace overtures, negotiated settlements, which Grant is having to navigate. He's kind of the liaison. All that fades away, though, with the beginning of the Appomattox campaign. This, again, is a quick outline. And you show how rapidly everything finally comes apart. After all those years of resistance, literally in less than 2 weeks, the Army of Northern Virginia is beaten. Just thoroughly beaten. Driven out of Richmond, chased across Central Virginia, southern portion of Central Virginia, along the Appomattox River, and then hemmed in and compelled to surrender. Farmville is an interesting spot to go down and visit, where Grant begins the correspondence with Lee concerning surrender. And then the final surrender is signed on April 9th. Grant was often plagued by headaches. He had migraines throughout his life, and supposedly he had a terrible headache when the first correspondence came from Lee suggesting that he wanted to end the war, and word is that Grant's headache went away immediately, which some stress may have been part of that headache. The surrender took place at the McLean House. This, I believe, is a picture of the original McLean House. What you see now in Appomattox is a reconstruction of the McLean House. But there's lots of photos of people who are in the room. There's lots of legends about what happened here at Appomattox, who was there, what happened afterwards, what happened to the furniture. Lots of letters that I edited when I was with the papers, Ulysses S. Grant, were people questioning about that. And Grant always had a fairly straightforward and simple explanation that's in accord with what's in his memoirs, is that, you know, he and Grant got together, the staff officers, same thing, exchanged the proper documents, they signed them, there was some chit-chat. No great secrets, or at least he was very consistent. As you all know, though, after the surrender, when all this momentum Grant was able to maintain and to bring victory to the Union cause, there certainly wasn't a period of harmony or moving together. It was Lincoln's assassination caused an awful lot of jaggedness. John Wilkes Booth assassinated Lincoln at Ford's Theater. Grant was supposed to be there. Julia did not get along with Mary Todd Lincoln, and they decided they weren't going to go that night and said they were going to go visit their children who were in school in southern New Jersey. And that's why Grant was not in Ford's Theater that night. He always wondered if things would have been different if he had been there. Would he have been alert and realized what Booth was trying to do and been able to stop it? We'll never know because he wasn't there. This is where Lincoln died the next morning, his bed, and this is Grant in mourning for Lincoln. He's got the little dark collar straps on in the later spring of 1865. Even with the sadness politically and the problems of getting back together, there still was reason for the Union side to celebrate the end of the war. So they have the grand review of the two armies. The Army of the Potomac marched on the 23rd May, and then Sherman completing the march back to Washington, D.C., gets the Western armies. Most of them, some of them stayed in the West to occupy area. But he comes back and marches the Western armies on May 24. This is Sherman here in advance with the sword, and Grant is over here with Andrew Johnson being saluted. This is the artist's rendition of it, a really nice picture, one that I like. And Grant and Sherman were great friends. And so this was the two of them getting together again, even though they had had some meetings at City Point, and they had seen each other, and there was some problems in North Carolina. Grant had to take a quick trip down there in late April to sort some things out. But this marks the end of the war, which Grant successfully completed, and he stayed on as general of the army until he became president. And that's a whole other story, which we'll leave for another time. But his success as a general was largely because he came up with a very basic plan, and then he stayed with it, and he executed it. And when things were going badly and things were challenging, he didn't panic. He kept his head. And he always retained his confidence and his composure. And like I said, I think I root a lot of that back into his childhood and his growing up experience and his family experience. And then just also his own sense of faith and purpose. So this is why he prevailed and a lot of other Union generals didn't, particularly against Lee, who was a very formidable opponent. So happy to take questions and comments. Other things you want to add would be fine.
For the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, I'm Dan Gould.